This is WJBC This Week.
Shocked. Shocked you, darling.
You hear about this and you watch TV and you see this, but when it happens to your family, you're just on the floor.
For the defendant in this case, it'll end someday when his sentence is over. But for them, it'll never end, and this is not a good day for anyone.
I'm mad as hell. I mean, I'm serious. I'm mad as hell.
We go to Springfield, and unless there's an agreement, we're just wasting time.
Those kinds of recreational facilities, I hear people saying those are wants, not needs. Well, you know, I challenge that.
That's a Redbird winner and a Central Division title for the St. Louis Cardinals.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stark. On this week's program, Illinois State's emergency manager discusses the school's response plans in the wake of a mass shooting at a college in Oregon. ABC Nightline co-anchor Dan Harris shares his personal journey to become a Buddhist and how he claims meditation has made him happier. We'll talk to an Illinois Wesleyan alum who won a genius grant. An editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac offers a prediction for the winter, plus WJBC's Throwback Thursday interview with Rick Fox. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The mass shooting at a community college in the Oregon Timberland this week had schools across the country reviewing their readiness plans should they ever have to respond to such a disaster. WJBC's Terry James talked with the emergency manager at Illinois State University, Eric Hodges, this week.
When you're talking about being the emergency manager for the university, what type of emergencies are you looking at?
So we have emergencies every day. There's a medical issue or a small trauma or something like that. It's really when it elevates to the point of disrupting a portion of the institution, or there's a lot of people involved, or it rises to something that is extraordinary in scope or size or impact to the institution. That's when I would get involved in preparedness and response.
Is ISU a pretty open place? I know that when I've covered news conferences there, it isn't like a grade school now where you have to talk over an intercom or speak over an intercom to get in the door. Just about anybody could walk in there. Is that correct?
Yeah, institutions of higher education are notoriously open, welcoming campuses, much like libraries. And we are very much an open campus. Our doors are open throughout the day, and the public and certainly our students are welcome anytime.
After hearing about yesterday and, of course, all the other incidents over the year and the past few years, what do you think is the best plan of action forward to keep students safe at ISU?
Focusing a lot on prevention and preparedness. We're one of the few states in the union that have a requirement to have behavioral intervention teams, or these teams that attempt to prevent acts of violence or major incidents before they actually happen. And we have two of those on campus. And again, it's strictly focused on prevention. And for those things that can't be prevented, we spend a lot of time on preparedness. Exercises, drills, planning, outreach, continually pressing home the message of what individuals can do on their own to be prepared.
With 20,000 students at Illinois State University, in fact, I think it's more than that this year, how do you get that message to them? Are there tests as far as what they know in their mind to do? And do you actually act out preparedness scenes?
Yeah, the biggest tool that we encourage our students and employees to sign up for is ISU Emergency Alert. That is our mass notification system, and it is an extremely mature system that we have. When we issue out an emergency alert, it goes out over text messaging. Every one of our desk phones, Twitter, Facebook, and now has all of our classroom projectors in it, digital displays, our websites, speakers, and so forth. It is the best tool that we have at the institution for warning our campus that a major emergency is taking place. But beyond that, we do a lot of preparedness and outreach activities. Myself and the police department have trained over 2,000 people on campus in the last 2 years on emergency preparedness. And earlier this year, at the end of March, we conducted a very large-scale active shooter exercise in the residence halls that are about to come down.
How did you feel about the results of that active shooter exercise?
We got out of it exactly what we were hoping for. There was a lot of collaboration amongst the public safety agencies, because we invited about 10 of them to work together, and then we deliberately invited about 50 students and faculty members to serve as role players. And that was especially important to me, that they have an opportunity to see hands-on how an incident as tragic as an active shooter might unfold on campus. So the feedback was really good, and I was very happy that we spent the year to plan for that that 3-hour exercise.
Again, we're talking with Eric Hodges, with the emergency manager for Illinois State University. All right, Eric, let's say that there's a report of someone who has a gun and walks into a science lab, using yesterday's example. What then happens across the university?
So as soon as we get conference, so there'll be an initial 911 call, and then we will dispatch officers. If there is corroboration, another call or a couple of other reports, then we will immediately issue out an ISU emergency alert. And our police department does that. They don't have to seek approval from anybody. They get to issue that alert themselves, which is excellent because it gets the message out quickly without delay. So then that goes out. And then part of that message will be active shooter at a particular facility, take appropriate precautions. Because we no longer just teach this lockdown approach, which is a sort of a single response doctrine. Instead, now we teach run, hide, fight, which is a nationwide program that provides for a range of options based on where you're at in the facility and where the suspect is. So we will put all of those messages out within the first minute or so, and then as people are taking appropriate actions, law enforcement is responding in force.
Run, hide, fight. Can you explain that to me?
Sure. Run is your first best option is, if you feel it's safe to do so, run away from the building. Get out of the building and run away to an area that you believe to be safe. If that doesn't work, then you hide. Hide is traditionally your lockdown approach, where you would close the door, close the blinds, lock the door, barricade the doors, go all quiet in a room, and make it as difficult as possible for that bad guy to get in. And then third, if that fails, if you're face to face with that suspect, then your last option is fight, and that's where you fight with everything you have, anything that you find around you, you use to try to take that person out.
I heard you mention something earlier that caught my ear. You mentioned that the emergency system is hooked into projectors. So if there is an incident, would the projector automatically turn on and alert everyone in that classroom?
So the way it works is if the professor has the computer turned on and is actively displaying on the wall, on the screen, for example, then as soon as we issue out the alert, within about 30 seconds, that message will take over their screen and present on the wall. So it doesn't turn on the projector, but if the faculty member is actively using the computer attached to the projector, it will take over that screen, whatever they're doing, and show this message full screen, and it is big and it is bright.
And then also, anyone who is part of the emergency alert system, will their phones be going off at that time?
They will. We've found that the text messaging option that we use is by far the most reliable. By the time we hit send, our police department hits send on that emergency alert, our people are getting it within 7 seconds. 92% of them have it within 19 seconds, and almost 100% of them have it within 30 seconds. And we have about 40% of our campus signed up for it. So it is an excellent method of very rapid notification.
And just so everyone understands, who is allowed to have weapons on campus?
With concealed carry, right now only law enforcement. We have signs all over our buildings so that it's clear to people, even though concealed carry is allowed in Illinois, it is not allowed within our facilities. So no one can carry inside of our facilities.
All right, and I do want to touch on a couple other things. Like you said, an emergency can range from many other things. We have had afternoons here where there have been possible tornado touchdowns in McLean County. What is the protocol for that?
ISU, just in this last 6 months, has developed a storm spotter program. So we have, I think it's 33 individuals who have gone through the National Weather Service Storm Spotter Training Program, which is coordinated out of our police department. So if we have some storms approaching, or severe weather, not just storms, but severe weather approaching, we will activate the team, and then we will coordinate with McLean County Emergency Management Agency any reports that we happen to see, and then that will help them make the decision to set off the tornado sirens or the outdoor warning sirens. If that happens, we also issue out an ISU emergency alert for that, and then we will tell people to seek shelter in an appropriate location.
That was ISU Emergency Manager Eric Hodges with Terry James. ABC Nightline co-anchor Dan Harris is someone you might call a secular Buddhist. He claims meditation has changed his life and is now spreading the message to others through the book 10% Happier. He talked about his journey with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
When we talked to you before, Dan, we talked about how you had this journey from the panic attack that you had on air on Good Morning America in 2004 to finding your way into the practice of meditation. And one of the things that's interesting about that is that your assignment in covering the beat of religion kind of led you to the path that you're on now. How did that happen? I guess Peter Jennings assigned you to that beat?
That's absolutely right, that the beat led me to what to this new sort of mission that I'm on. And yeah, I was assigned by Peter Jennings, who was my mentor at the time, to cover faith and spirituality, which I didn't want to do because I was raised in the People's Republic of Massachusetts by a pair of intensely secular scientists. And it turned out to be a great thing. You know, first of all, I learned a lot about the world of faith and spirituality, about which I was, you know, incredibly ignorant. And then eventually I kind of stumbled into, from a journalistic standpoint, covering the world of self-help. And that ultimately led me, by the way, I wasn't a big fan of self-help. I thought there was a lot of malarkey being peddled there. But it did ultimately lead me to learning about the science that says meditation is really good for you. And I had always assumed that meditation was only for weirdos, rogue gurus, et cetera, but it turns out, you know, it can lower your blood pressure, boost your immune system, and rewire key parts of your brain. And that's why I started doing it.
Well, you talk about the science involved with the practice of meditation, and a lot of neuroscientists in the last 10 years have really been studying the brain and are able to see things happening physiologically in the brain under different conditions. And it seems unlikely, but you're involved. You've partnered with Joseph Goldstein, who is this Buddhist scholar and a tech startup, and you're involved in this app. What about technology and science is informing how this app works, and can you explain what it is?
Sure. So to back up a second, I ended up writing a book about my experiences called 10% Happier, and it's about how a fidgety, skeptical newsman became a daily practitioner of meditation. And the title itself is a bit of a joke. It's kind of counter-programming against what I find to be the over-promising in the self-help world. And, you know, if you had told me just a couple of years ago that I was ever going to end up being a public evangelical for meditation, I would have coughed my beer up through my nose. But here I am. And after the book came out, I was approached by a startup company out of Boston to do an app that teaches people how to meditate. I am not, however, a qualified meditation teacher. So we brought in my meditation teacher, a guy named Joseph Goldstein, and we created a two-week course called 10% Happier. You can get it in the Apple App Store, or you can get it at, if you don't have an Apple phone, you can get it on 10percenthappier.com. And it's a two-week course. It'll cost you a few bucks, but you can get started for free if you want to just check it out. And it's short daily doses of meditation designed for skeptics. And that's the deal. And, you know, we talk a lot about the science because science is something that is very attractive to people who otherwise might reflexively reject it.
Well, it's kind of strange to think of something as distracting as a smartphone can actually be a tool for mindfulness.
I love it. Because it's like the ultimate judo move. These devices are, you know, completely destroying our ability to focus. But you can harness them to boost your ability to focus. It's entirely possible. And we're certainly not the first mover in this space. There's another company called Headspace which has been around for a while. They're great. They also have an app. But we're coming in and trying to do it from a little bit of a different angle. We're a little bit more designed for the skeptic. And also, we have this one feature that's unique, which is that at any time you can text or email a coach who is assigned to you, who's a real human being, who can answer your questions at any time. And that's a big deal because, you know, as soon as you start doing this practice, you will have questions.
You know, when you've talked about the fact that you have become a spokesperson in a way for meditation and mindfulness, and that you came to that from a skeptical mindset, you mentioned the skepticism, you now identify yourself as Buddhist. And I wonder I wonder if that has affected how people perceive you as a person, but also as a news person, because we don't necessarily think of anchors as cynical, you know, of taking a cynical eye of looking only thing for the facts. So anytime you get anywhere in the realm that overlaps at all with spirituality, do you find that people immediately raise an eyebrow?
I haven't found it yet, but, you know, here's my wrap on the whole Buddhist thing. Well, first of all, let me just say something about cynicism versus skepticism. I think there's a big difference between the two. I think there's nothing wrong with being skeptical, but cynicism has sort of a negative connotation where you're only looking for the negative. You're not even open to the positive, as opposed to just asking hard questions from a position of, you know, sort of good faith. But I don't mean faith in the traditional sense there. In terms of Buddhism, it means more and less than you might think. Less because it's not a religion in the way most people practice religion. Buddhism can be practiced as a religion, there's no question about it, but the Buddha himself said very clearly, I'm going to make a few metaphysical claims, you can take them or leave them. And there's no story about the origins of the universe or anything like that. And so you can practice Buddhism if you are a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or, like me, a respectful agnostic. It's just a set of tools for being more sane. And my favorite quote about this is that it's not something to believe in, it's something to do. I view it as exercise for your brain. So to me, saying I'm a Buddhist is, you know, this is a rough comparison, but not entirely different from saying I'm a guy who worked out.
Is there something, though, different about Buddhism and the practice of a secular mindfulness for you?
There is. But it can become sort of a semantic difference, because the fact is that secular meditation is derived from Buddhism. And I think the advent of secular meditation is a fantastic thing, because there are a lot of people who are just uncomfortable with being associated with Eastern spirituality, no matter what. So I think the fact that it's been secularized, that a kind of meditation has come around that strips all the Buddhist language out of it, no metaphysics, has been extraordinarily helpful to tens of millions of people, perhaps. There are some critics of that who worry that once you strip out the Buddhist ethic, that somehow the practice can become craven or hollow. I have some sympathy with that argument. It's just at the end of the day, for me, more mindfulness is better than less mindfulness. If you're teaching people how, and this is what meditation does, it teaches you how to be less emotionally reactive, more focused, more calm. You know, if stripping the Buddhism out of that makes it more attractive to people, imagine the impact on parenting in our society, road rage, politics, journalism, if people were more emotionally intelligent and more focused and kinder. I just think there's no way that's a bad thing.
That was ABC Nightline co-anchor and Buddhist author Dan Harris with Steve Fast. An Illinois Wesleyan grad was named a winner of a so-called Genius Grant this week for his ongoing efforts helping low-income Latino immigrants in Chicago. Juan Salgado from Chicago's South Side founded Instituto del Progreso Latino, and he talked with WJBC's Joe Ragusa this week.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your work with that institute?
Yeah. So
So I've always been interested from the time I was at Wesleyan in issues of upward mobility and issues of economics, issues of growth of our economy. And I actually studied economics there, and then I went to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where I grew an interest in urban and regional planning and the development of cities, right? And, of course, Chicago is my city. And when you look at what is happening in our city is that we have this set of jobs that are going unfilled. There are jobs in manufacturing, there are jobs in healthcare, there are jobs in transportation and logistics. They're those middle class, middle skilled jobs that people can make a living off of and have a high quality of life, a good quality of life. And yet we have these people in neighborhoods, in these communities, with all the skills and abilities to be able to access those jobs. They're just not. We're just not closing the gap. We're not finding the solutions. We're not bringing these folks into those occupations fast enough to grow our economy, and so that's the thing I wanted to tackle. That's the thing that I am tackling. That's the thing that our organization is tackling, and we've been doing it quite well. By the way, we've been getting really great results. And in working in a partnership with our college systems, with our employer community, with hospitals, with manufacturers, and as a result, you know, not only does a family's economy get better, but our neighborhoods are brighter, and our city is better off, right? So we just have to do more of this. We have to double down, and we have to move faster and quicker.
And certainly the money from this fellowship grant is going to help that. And I want to ask you again, I mean, you touched base on this just a moment ago, but how exactly does the Instituto del Progreso Latino work?
How do we work? We work inside of the Latino community on the southwest side of the city. 500,000 people reside in these communities. And we look at where our community is educationally. Often fourth grade reading, fifth grade reading, sixth grade reading levels in English. Why? Because they come from another country. And yet they have a great desire to learn a language. They have a great desire to advance their families. And so we create dynamic education solutions that move them quickly into college, because for you to get those middle skill jobs, you don't have to have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree or a doctorate, but you do have to be able to pass 6, 7, 8 core courses in college that are instrumental for you to get a license, practical nursing credential, to get manufacturing credentials in industrial maintenance or in computer numerical control operations. So you have to be a college-ready student. And what we're doing is turning these immigrant families into successful college completers at the certificate level and middle-class families at the end of the day.
And you also started a charter school in 2010, kind of along the same lines, correct?
Well, so what happened here with the charter school is that our healthcare partners were very satisfied, and they said, well, this is great. You're helping us with nurses, but we have all these other occupations, and we have these needs in those occupations, and couldn't you help us with that? And so our response to that was, let's do a charter school. Let's do a charter school that takes kids, you know, at 7th and 8th grade and begins to say to them, come to a school when you come to high school that will expose you to health careers. And so right now our kids, they intern at Baxter International and learn about biomedicine. They intern at the Lurie Children's Hospital, Rush University Medical Center. They are interning across healthcare institutions across our city while they're in high school. And they're learning math in the context of English. I mean, in the context of healthcare. They're learning English in the context of healthcare. And so they're not just learning about healthcare occupations. They're also learning about how to be healthy themselves throughout their lifetimes and how to help their families to be healthy as well. And so we came up with a great concept, and we now have 750 kids enrolled in this school that's performing very well academically.
That was Illinois Wesleyan alum Juan Salgado, a Genius Grant winner, with Joe Ragusa. Today's local news is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The Old Farmer's Almanac has long been a go-to for long-term weather predictions. Now that we are officially into fall, WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds talked with contributing editor Sarah Perrault this week about the almanac, its predictions, and its accuracy.
What part of the country do you live in?
I'm in New England, New Hampshire to be exact.
Oh, okay. So I imagine when this comes out, one of the first things you do is look to see what kind of winter you're going to have. God forbid you should have one like last year.
I'm really hoping we won't, but for our area, we are predicting cold and snow, which is nothing new for New England, but not as harsh as last year, so I'm pretty excited about that.
All right, we're going to talk more than about the weather, but let's talk on the weather here, because we in central Illinois, we can run the gamut here, and I'm just looking at a general map of the Old Farmer's Almanac, their weather map for the winter, and we are right now, it says cold and dry, but we aren't that far away, and I'm talking maybe 50 miles from being cold and snowy or normal temps and dry, because we're right
That's
in the...
That's right. Illinois is kind of divided into three different weather systems this winter, but right where you are, you're going to be having... below normal temperatures, but below normal snow. So depending on what kind of winter you like, you might be happy with that. If you want a little bit warmer and drier, then you should be on the western part of your state. Or if you love cold and snow, head south.
South. All right. Or way north, up in Wisconsin, Minnesota. It looks like they're going to be cold and snowy, too. Let me ask you, though, how accurate is this? For example... did the Old Farmer's Almanac predict the winter that Boston had last year correctly?
For Boston, we predicted they were going to have above average snow. We had no idea it was going to be that far above average. But see, we get to call it right because we did say above average.
Yeah, right.
Susan, you talk about in the book, what is shaping the weather? And one of the things you mentioned is solar cycle 24 is now in its declining phase after reaching double peaks in 2011 and 2014. What does that mean?
Well, when you're looking at solar cycles, which is a huge part of our forecast, you're looking at the frequency and the size of sunspots because they change from year to year. And right now, they are small and few and far between, and that indicates a cooling of the Earth's atmosphere, which explains the very cold winters that we've been experiencing.
And, of course, that also relates to El Nino, and we know we are in an El Nino, right?
Right. We're forecasting a slightly different El Nino than the National Weather Service is. We're forecasting a weak to neutral phase, but we recognize we could be wrong about that, and if we are wrong, that means California will get some of the rain it desperately needs. So if we're wrong, we're going to be pretty happy about that.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned, though, that, and I know there's concern right now about a hurricane, going to be a more active hurricane season than last year?
Yeah, last year would be considered this year because we're looking at the 2016. So yeah, we're predicting that the 2016 hurricane season will be active than the one we're in right now. But the one we're in right now hasn't been terribly active, unless you're talking about right exactly this minute.
Joaquin's knocking at the door of the Carolinas.
And for the Midwest, there is some concern about drought in the summer. Is that right?
Yeah, it looks like summer across most of the nation is going to be hot and dry, with exceptions of not California, but the Northwest. Looks like it's going to be a bit wet, but most of the nation's going to have hot and dry summer next year.
All right. Now, and how accurate, I'm sure you have a percentage or some numbers here, how accurate over the years has the Old Farmer's Almanac been for predicting the weather for the entire country?
Well, we do crunch the numbers every year, and our traditional accuracy rate, we always come in around 80%, but for last year, we were well above average. At 96.3% accurate, I think that's the most accurate we have ever been, at least in the 13 years that I've been here.
96?
96.3. Don't forget the .3.
All right, 96.3. 3.
You know, I'm thumbing through your latest Farmer's Almanac, and the header says, useful with a pleasant degree of humor. I didn't really realize that the old Farmer's Almanac had humor.
Oh, sure it does. Tell me about the skydiving beavers, can you?
Oh, absolutely. There were some beavers in Montana that were being encroached upon because they were developing where they lived, and they needed to move them to safety or, you know, so that they could continue to live their fruitful lives. But there was no easy way to do it to get them from where they were to where they needed to go. So they tested out. They took one beaver, named him Geronimo. They put a parachute on him and tested out relocating them by parachute to their new to where their new living situation was going to be, and it worked, so they sent the rest of them skydiving.
That was Sarah Peralta of the Old Farmer's Almanac with Scott and Colleen. WJBC's Throwback Thursday interview was with Rick Fox, a news reporter who was here for a short time but saw and reported on quite a lot, including Y2K. As he talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Boy, do I remember. Now, for those that don't remember, everyone thought the world was going to end at the end of 1999. How did WJBC handle that?
Well, I don't remember all of the plans, although I do remember we spent a lot of time planning for our coverage on New Year's Eve. And instead of spending that evening with our loved ones going out, I remember I was at an ATM in downtown Bloomington at 12:01, put my ATM in the card in the machine, and guess what happened? Money came out.
Oh, my goodness.
Everything worked. There was a whole lot of nothing that happened that night, to be honest.
That was such a big issue back then, and everyone was afraid. Of course, if you don't remember, everything was set up with a 19 at the beginning, and computers were set up the same way, where you just entered a two-year code. Well, we never thought about the new millennium. So that was the big story then. Were people surprised that you got money out at that time?
Well, I know I wasn't sure what to expect. Again, it's a no-brainer now looking back on it that everything worked. But at the time, I wasn't sure if I was going to get my bank card back. I wasn't going to sure if it was going to take more money out of my account, and there wasn't a lot in there in the first place. But when the $20 bill came out, I was happy to report to everybody that everything seemed like it was just business as usual.
One thing that's continued over the 90 years here at WJBC has been our coverage of severe weather, and you were no stranger to that.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was my first week on the job. I had moved here, moved to Bloomington from Columbus, Ohio, and I was in town for about a week, and I got sent to the McLean County Emergency Management Association's building to cover severe weather. I wasn't even sure where the building was. Found it down in the basement working with the weather spotters and the team down there. Spent a couple of hours on air going back and forth with R.C. McBride and other people out in the communities. And I didn't know what the surrounding communities were, the directions, but we had 7 tornadoes, I believe it was, that touched down on that day. And it was just incredible activity, a lot of information flying around, and just a lot of excitement.
Absolutely, and we still deal with that today, as just tornadoes are attracted to this area, it seems. We've had a few this year for sure. You also went to Decatur. Now, this was a pretty big deal. I do remember this. Jesse Jackson was in Decatur. Why was he there, and tell me what that led to.
All right, going back about 16 years now, I guess it was. So I believe there were 5 or 6 students, all African-American teenagers, at one of the high schools in Decatur. And there was video of a brawl at a football game. And these 5 students were captured on the video, and they were all expelled from school. And there were some people who thought that it was just, others who thought it was unjust. And Jesse Jackson came down, and he spent better part of a week in Decatur bringing attention, and he brought a lot of attention to the issue. I know we were standing there with CNN, and you know all of the national affiliates were there covering this. And tell you a little funny story that happened there is my cell phone. Again, this was the early days of cell phones, and my cell phone battery was dying. And I actually, Willis Kern from the NPR affiliate lent me his cell phone, and I delivered a live report using his cell phone that ended up that we won a Murrow Award for spot newscasting, and it was using his phone. And I've thanked him since then, but it was an interesting day.
Yeah, Will is still a good friend of the station here and still working in the community. A very good guy. We've heard about marriages inside the station, but you crossed over to newspaper when you were looking for a wife. Is that correct?
Yeah, my wife actually, she's what brought me to Bloomington in the first place. We were engaged, and she was working as an education reporter at the Pantograph, and brought me to Bloomington with her, back to my home state. So came home, and while I was at WJBC, she was at the Pantograph, and our paths crossed occasionally. In fact, she was also the newbie, I think, on that day where the tornadoes hit. She was covering severe weather that day as well.
So we love to name drop during this segment. Can you tell us who was on the air, who was in the newsroom? Who do you remember at WJBC while you were here?
Well, Don Munson was there. I think it was his last year there, though. He was retiring that year from the full-time morning show. Scott came on board that year. Colleen Reynolds was news director with R.C. McBride was the assistant news director. There was some transition during that time as well. Beth Elizabeth Wissman was there, Craig Feda, and one of my favorites, Howard Packaway.
Oh, we love Howard. Jamie Monticelli as well, and who was on the air after Dawn? I mean, were they still playing music at that time?
There was very little music, but that was Scott and Nancy came on in the morning.
Dawn. Yeah, that's right. I remember. And we talked with Nancy Thiel. She is out in Nevada now, working near Reno. So yep. She is out there right now. What have you been up to? What have you been doing?
I've done a little bit of a lot of different things since I left. I went on to be the news director at WJOL, the radio station in Joliet, for a short time. And then I moved on into public relations. My years of covering city council meetings and board meetings led me to actually run for office. I was elected twice in my hometown. I sat on the village board for about 7 years. And I've taught courses in crisis communications and public relations at Columbia College in Chicago as well.
Do you think the Jesse Jackson time and the severe weather all led to that job at Columbia College?
Well, it certainly helped as I was teaching students and providing real-life examples of what can happen and how to handle things. Certainly gave me a lot of good background.
That was WJBC's Throwback Thursday interview, Rick Fox, with Terry James. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Former ISU student Joshua Dunn was found guilty of aggravated driving under the influence this week in relation to a hit-and-run death of ISU student Benjamin Allison in January. Blood tests done after the incident revealed Dunn had marijuana in his system. Prosecutor Jeff Horv says there are no winners in this case.
The Allisons lost their only son, and for them, this will never be over. Jordan and Joey lost their best friend, and this will never be over for them. For the defendant in this case, it'll end someday when his sentence is over. But for them, it'll never end, and this is not a good day for anyone.
Dunn faces up to 29 years in prison when he is sentenced next month. Bloomington and Normal have both passed a 1% sales tax increase, and local school districts are hoping some of the revenue is headed their way. Normal City Manager Mark Peterson says no one has reached out to the town council yet, but judging from how Bloomington has reacted, school officials may not like what they hear.
And the feedback we're getting is the city, even though we all acknowledge the schools need money, as many organizations and institutions do in town, that probably isn't in the cards for the school.
Bloomington is using 75% of its new revenue to cover part of its structural deficit next year and to resurface roads. Normal's town council will discuss its options at a meeting tomorrow night. A local personal aid worker is frustrated that state lawmakers continue to take long breaks, even though Illinois has been without a budget for 3 months. Linda Harper is paid by the state and for now is getting paychecks, but says that could stop if the budget impasse continues.
I'm mad as hell. I mean, you know, I'm serious. I'm mad as hell. We are really mad as hell. But, you know, we feel this way. You know, numerous people are convinced that a shutdown of the government is Governor Rauner's intention.
Harper says in-home health care, child care, nursing home aid programs could all be cut if there's no budget in place soon. Performers at Conklin's Dinner Theater have taken their final bow. The barn in Goodfield is closing just short of its 40th anniversary. Owner Mary Simon says the theater won't be able to reopen after the barn was damaged in a storm in August. Simon says the theater's insurance claim was denied and the building was deemed unrepairable, even though, according to Simon, the insurance company insured the business as structurally sound without riders or restrictions in April. She says that left the theater in extreme financial peril, and it's not financially feasible to reopen at a temporary site. And Time Magazine's Person of the Year was on the ISU campus this week. Ellis Stryker, a health promoter with the Doctors Without Borders, spent much of last year dealing with the Ebola outbreak in Africa that she says could have been handled better.
I think it's well understood that this was a failure not just of WHO, but of the global community. It's a massive failure. I put this on the level of genocide in Rwanda in terms of our inability to address a situation that could have been prevented.
Stryker says most of the people who responded to the Ebola outbreak are still in Africa working to control the disease. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time to take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Normal's Town Council will discuss how it will spend the money it's due to receive from its recent 1% sales tax increase. Also Monday, two Twin City grade schools, Stevenson and Prairie Land, will roll out Project Fit America, a national public charity dedicated to getting kids fit. And McLean County Board of Members will update the community on the McLean County Mental Health Action Plan at the ISU Alumni Center. On Tuesday, a Bloomington Public Library Committee will discuss adding more bookmobile stops on the city's west side. Wednesday, Bloomington murder defendant Kirk Zimmerman is due back in court following another delay. Prosecution is trying to get Zimmerman's defense attorney removed from the case. And on Friday, the National League Division Series will get underway in St. Louis as the Cardinals await the winner of a one-game wild card between the Chicago Cubs and Pittsburgh Pirates. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.